I'd like to call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It's 1:02 p.m. Friday, April 26, 2019. Members present are Representative Hannon, Representative Rauscher, Vice Chair Representative Hopkins, Co-Chair Representative Tarr, and myself, Representative Lincoln. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. And before we get started, please silence your cell phones. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast, and our LIO moderator, Eric Heimbigner. Our first order of business today is an update on the Alaska commercial fishing industry from Francis Leach, Executive Director of the United Fisheries of Alaska. Second, DNR will provide an update on ASTAR. And last but not least, the committee will hear House Resolution 8 and consider two amendments. Ms. Leach, would you please come forward and put yourself on the record? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had mentioned to you that a little piece from the last presentation on fish tax is not at me, so I went and did another little piece of homework to get an explanation. And if I could give that short explanation. During the fish tax presentation from the Department of Revenue on slide 19, there was a zero allocation in FY 2018 under the common property fish assessment. And there was some ambiguity about whether it was a problem or what was the problem and why did it go from a million in 2014 to zero. And the problem isn't a bad problem. The problem, so cost recovery is what the hatchery is allowed to do to pay for their operating overhead. And all the other hatcheries in the state besides Hidden Falls Hatchery basically hire a fish group under a contract and say, go fish for us. And once they get their cost recovery, then the rest of the fish are available for allocation. Hidden Falls does it differently, and I didn't research why they do it differently. They don't hire a fisherman under contract. They are in a terminal area, and any fish that are caught in that area, they get 20% of that fishery. And so in FY14, their 20% take was over $1 million. In FY2018, when it drops to zero, it's not for a bad reason. It's that the rest of the nonprofit hatcheries, and in particular in this region, the local hatchery here, DIPAC, Douglas Island Pink and Chum, has been so successful, has paid off all their loan debt. They are required to use their expenses or their profits up. So they've shared and covered the cost recovery at Hidden Falls completely. So 100% of the fishery at Hidden Falls was able to be caught by fishermen, and they did not have to share their profit. So although the common property fish assessment went to zero, we should have recouped a much higher rate in business tax or landing tax because the fishermen in that fishery got 100% of the take in FY2018. And none of the cost recovery had to be covered by that fishery because DIPAC has paid off their fisheries enhancement loan and now is making so much money, and they've built all the facilities they could build in the last few years. So they're paying for other hatcheries to continue to operate.
Interesting.
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Ms. Leach, third time's a charm.
Okay. Thank you, Chairs Lincoln and Tarr, and members of the House Resource Committee. For the record, my name is Frances Leach, and I'm the Executive Director of United Fishermen of Alaska. Before I start, I'd like to just give some thanks to some folks who helped me with these, put these slides together. Julianne Curry of Icicle Seafoods lent me several of her slides, and Mark Vinsel, who is our operations manager at UFA, is my data guru. So I got a lot of good data from Mark, and also there will be some slides from ASME. So I'll just start off by telling you a little bit about United Fishermen of Alaska. United Fishermen of Alaska was started in 1974 by a group of commercial fishermen who wanted to have a unified voice for commercial fishing in the state of Alaska. We have several primary objectives, and I'll quickly run through these because they are very important to our industry. So the first one is to promote positive relations between industry sectors, to support all commercial gear types and remain neutral on allocative issues between commercial gear groups, For example, we don't want to pit our trollers against our gillnetters, against our seiners, so we do remain neutral in all allocative issues. Protect the industry from attacks through initiatives and legislation. Promote industry safety. Promote healthy fishery resources by supporting research and habitat protection. That's very important because we recognize without habitat protection, that does not make our fisheries as strong for the future. Support adequate funding for fisheries research, management, enforcement. That's why we're staunch protectors of the ADF&G budget. Oppose all types of fish farming for finfish. Support development of new fisheries. Educate the industry and public and the government. Support efforts to increase consumption of Alaska seafoods. Promote quality standards of harvester to consumer. And promote consumer access to seafood by maintaining a stable supply of product to processors.
Before you move on, I neglected to note that Representative Sponholz and Talrigo join us at about 1:05 p.m.
So this is a quick slide that just shows all of our UFA member associations and areas that we operate. We are an Alaskan-based organization. We currently have 36 member groups, and you can see they span all over Alaska's coastlines. These are representing commercial fishermen, Alaska commercial fishermen, and crew members. We also have individual Alaska fishing permit holder memberships, as well as crew member memberships, community memberships, and business memberships. So we have several memberships that we represent.
Questions? Coach Yatar?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For all of the 37, did you say member groups?
36.
Do they all have staff themselves, just to get a sense of the relative size? Because some of them I recognize and have worked with, but all of them I'm not sure if I recognize. And, you know, just a sense of sort of like their operation. Is it each have like one staff kind of thing or more?
Through the chair, Reptar, yes, that is correct. They usually have at least one staff member. They have an executive director, typically, and if they're lucky, they have another additional staff member. What we find with our boards is usually they have board member, and they all have boards. They all operate as a board, and so their board members serve on our board as representation for their organization so that they all have a voice on our organization. Thank you. So as I said, one of our main goals is sustainability and management. Thankfully, Alaska wrote a sustainability mandate into our constitution in 1959. We arguably have one of the best managed fisheries in the entire world, thanks to state, federal, and international agencies through a science-based public process. Our fisheries are seasonal and dynamic, and effective management as well as funding for that management is critical. The seafood industry is one of the most heavily regulated industries in all of Alaska. Science-based and caution approach includes shutdowns when the returns are low and if the research and stock surveys are not able to be funded. Closures caused by a lack of field data unnecessarily cost reductions in income for fisheries participants, and that goes for the state's general fund as well, which I'll talk a little bit in a few future slides. Our major fisheries management bodies include the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Alaska Board of Fisheries, Commercial Fisheries Entries Commission, National Marine Fisheries Service, North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, the International Pacific Halibut Commission, and the Pacific Salmon Commission. And of course, all of these have really cool acronyms that if I ever say it, you can ask me what it means. So who and what is Alaska's...
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. A lot of those different commissions and everything are federal, or have federal aspects to them. How were those impacted and the openings impacted when the federal government shutdown wasn't able to help operate some of those?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, it was very challenging, actually. You know, we do a lot of, NOAA does a lot of work with commercial fisheries. So it was, I mean, they were shut down, and there were permits that were affected. There were seiners in Southeast Alaska that I know were waiting to get their permits renewed. It was a very challenging time.
So there were fisheries that were not able to open. Alaskan fisheries were impacted. And then at
through the chair, Rep. Hopkins. Yes, I don't believe there were any actual fisheries that didn't happen on time, but the pending definitely, and there was a lot of concern out there that they wouldn't be happening if the shutdown had continued.
Quick follow-up. A few years ago when the legislature was debating the budget into June, and trying to figure out what that was going to look like. There was some effort. The administration was starting to look at what would be shut down. Would that have, if they had gone through the fiscal year, would fisheries have been shut down and not have been able to be open for these harvests?
Through the chair, Rep. Hopkins, that is correct. So the salmon season typically opens up in mid-June throughout the state, and so that was definitely a concern that area management biologists, if they had not been employed by the state at that time, that fisheries wouldn't have been able to start.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, who and what is Alaska Seafood? The seafood industries is Alaska's largest private sector employer, creating 60,000 direct jobs, and we are very proud of that. That includes fishermen, tenders, processors, and fisheries managers. There are over 320 fisheries species gear area combinations permitted in Alaska, and 80 of those are limited entry. 197 of these had fishing activities and deliveries in 2018. Alaska's commercial fisheries employed over 27,000 fishermen and crew in 2016, including 15,000 of those who were Alaska residents. Over 21,000 Alaska rural residents were employed by the seafood industry, and that is about makes up of 15% of rural jobs. Commercial fishing permit holders live in over 200 communities in the state, and there are over 20,000 commercial fishing crew members participating in Alaska's fisheries, and more than half of those are Alaska residents. The value of Alaska seafood. Seafood is a diverse industry. Both fishing businesses and processors range from large corporations to small family businesses and sole proprietors. There are over 80 different seafood species fished in Alaska, caught by over 6,500 boats and processed at over 120 shoreside plants. Between 5 to 6 billion pounds of seafood are harvested per year, and that's worth about 4 to 5 billion in first wholesale value in Alaska state waters and in federal fisheries in the EEZ off of Alaska. And this is the important part. Alaska fishermen and processors contributed over $146 million in federal, state, and local taxes and fees. Ex-vessel revenue amounted to $1.99 billion in 2017. Processing companies employed nearly 25,000 workers in 2015, including approximately 7,400 of those were Alaska residents. Seafood processing is the largest manufacturing sector in Alaska, which accounts for 72% of our manufacturing employment in the state. And seafood is our top export, with more than $3.4 billion in 2017. Of that, China bought $989 million, which was nearly a third of the state's total exports, seafood exports.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to be clear, when you say first wholesale value, is that's the first purchase there from the fisherman to the processor?
Through the chair, Rep. Tallarico, that is correct, and we call that ex vessel value.
Thank you.
That is what the commercial fisherman is getting paid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got a question on that slide also. I appreciate you breaking down the employment statistics by different sort of types of work in the industry. So approximately 50% of the people fishing in Alaska are not residents. Okay, and then?
Well, Chair Lincoln, I do break it down even further into the different sectors of commercial fishing, where you've got the processors and the plant workers, and so I'll go into those slides next, too.
Okay, so you have some more slides to?
Yes.
Okay, I'll save my question. Thank you.
Okay, this is a slide by the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. On the left, you have the harvest volume, that is the pounds of species being caught. And then on the right, you have the ex vessel value, that is what the commercial fisherman is getting paid in dollars. And so something unique to look at here is you can see on the left side, the pounds, you have Alaska pollock at 57% of our seafood caught. But then if you look over on the right, you see Alaska pollock. The value is only 22% of that. And so these are some unique different charts to look at side by side, because salmon, which makes up only 14% of the total pounds, is actually when it is the biggest value for Alaska seafood at 34%. And then you've got crab at 1% of the poundage, but it's making up 12% of the value. So I find this slide really interesting when you're looking. And I know there was a question asked by Rep. Rasmussen the other day regarding the landing taxes and if that was based by pound, but we're actually looking at it by the dollar here. So markets for Alaska seafoods. Seafood is Alaska's number one export. About 75% of seafood production is exported annually to 100 different countries. The United States is actually the largest market at 25 to 30%. And I actually was speaking to interim director of ASME, Jeremy Woodrow, today, and he said that can be up to 40% sometimes for U.S. consumption. China, South Korea are the largest trading partners, and that's primarily for reprocessing. So we send our fish over there to get reprocessed. Japan and Europe are largest direct foreign markets, and most Alaskans access their seafood through commercial fishing sector. So when you go to the grocery store and you buy Alaska salmon, that is caught by an Alaska commercial fisherman.
Can you describe some of the reprocessing that happens overseas?
I can try. Rep. Lincoln, I know that like pollock is a large one that is often sent over, and salmon is as well. And so it gets reprocessed and turned into, I believe the pollock is turned into like fish sticks and then sent back over here. That was a large concern also during the trade, the tariff situation, because there was a percentage put on that as well. Okay, fishing in Alaska, it's a way of life for generations. We are known for small boat family-style fishing operations, where countless fishing businesses are family-based, and in many cases, families have been harvesting fish for generations in the same way, in the same areas. Our fisheries support local economies and communities, and they're a valuable source of protein and nutrients that provides food security to people around the world. You can see here, you got my dad on the left. He's 77, and he's still actively commercial fishing. Doesn't plan on stopping, and then that's me. I grew up commercial fishing, and I try to get out with him as often as possible. And to continue with the generations, we've got my kids here helping pop the heads off some shrimp. So independent fishermen equals small business equals investment. Each fishing and processing operation represents a significant long-term investment in vessels and or facilities, permits, equipment, safety, and food safety compliance. Just to give you an idea, I was just looking up Southeast Seine permit prices. They are currently at $250,000 for a Southeast Seine permit. That's up $25,000 just from last fall. And when you look at having to purchase a $250,000 permit and on the cheap end a $500,000 boat, that's quite an investment that you're putting into your business. Here are national impacts of Alaska seafood industry, 2015 to 2016 average. This is a report put together by the McDowell Group. So on the left, you have the different sectors of employment for that the Alaska seafood industry brings. So you have commercial fishing, processing, management, distributors, grocers, restaurant. You can see the number of workers, the number of full-time equivalent jobs, labor income, that's their salary and benefits that they're receiving. And then the total economic output in the millions on the far right. And as you can see, the total economic output for the Alaska seafood industry is $12,758,000. So that's quite a bit.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you look at the restaurants, were they able to break out the restaurants that actually just sell some sort of seafood? Is that what we look at when we see restaurants? I mean, we're not looking at all restaurants, right? They're not just, but just those that sell seafood?
Through the chair, Rep. Tuck, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Let me just, through the chair, Ms. Leach, that's that restaurants that are selling Alaskan caught seafood. So we make sure that the record reflects that. It's not even all those seafood restaurants.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So, and going down to Dutch Harbor, and forgive me if I don't remember the number, but they have, I forgot what the percentage is, that McDonald's sells of Alaskan pollock. And, you know, they have all the technology they can, you know, they gotta make sure there's no bones in that and everything else, and they showed us the technologies, they showed us all that stuff. So would that include restaurants such as McDonald's?
Through the chair, Rep. excuse me, Yes, that would.
And if I remember correctly, I think it was 70% of McDonald's fish sandwiches is caught in Alaska. Wow. Surprisingly, yeah. If I remember correctly, I think it's pretty close.
Mm-hmm. I do know that when you drive by the McDonald's here, it says a wild Alaskan pollock. So it's always exciting to see, and there's definitely a source of pride there. Hey, nationwide impacts. People from every U.S. state fish as permit holders in Alaska's fisheries, yet over 69% of active permit holders and over 50% of crews are Alaskan residents. And I do want to stress that 69% of active permit holders are Alaska residents, and 50% of crew are Alaska residents. Nationally, the Alaska seafood industry creates 99,000 full-time equivalent jobs, $5.2 billion in annual labor income, and once again, $12.8 billion in economic output. The industry catches and processes enough seafood each year to feed everybody in the world, at least one serving of Alaska seafood, or one serving for every American for more than a month. That's 12.9 billion servings in 2015. Alaska has 9 of the nation's top 20 seafood ports by volume, and 19 of those are in the top 101. You can see Dutch Harbor is number 1, and we have number 2 is the Aleutian Islands, and number 3 is Kodiak. After that, you start moving around the coast into Bristol Bay and down into Southeast Alaska. But that's pretty impressive when you're looking at our worldwide ports and that Alaska has several of them and that we do take claim to the top 3.
And Mr. Chair. Also, when I went to Dutch Harbor, they were saying that Dutch Harbor is number 1 export port of the United States when it comes, I believe, poundage, or might be value, I can't remember, but the other one is in Boston, both related to the seafood industry. But one happens to be based on value, the other one happens, but we're neck and neck. So we're at least number 2 in the nation for export.
Okay, lowering the cost of living in Alaska. Who knew that the commercial fishing industry helped lower the cost of living in Alaska? But we do. Shipping seafood on southbound routes helps provide a backhaul revenue for shippers, which allows for more competitive rates on northbound freight. Our seafood industry ships approximately 1 billion pounds of finished products southbound each year, or the equivalent of 23,000 containers. And I'll leave you with this quote. Everyone benefits from the seafood industry, especially smaller communities in Western Alaska. And that is from Kevin Anderson, who's the president of Alaska Marine Lines. And that wraps up my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Leach. Any questions from the committee? Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. This might be a question for the department, but you probably look into it a bit. How do I get information on individual fisheries and how much are caught in there versus commercial versus sport and subsistence in the different fisheries?
That would, through the chair, Rep. Hopkins, that would definitely be a question for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Bug them. Do you guys track that as well?
You know, we do to a certain extent. We do put out this fish fact sheet, and we have them on every region in the state too. And so if you're looking for specific regions, I'd be happy to provide that. This mostly, it doesn't get down always to the poundage and the species though. So that would definitely be more of a question for ADF&G.
If you could send that to us, I would very much be interested in looking at these. This was a great factoid. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the slide that shows the ports. So I didn't realize Anchorage has actually get to 3.8 million pounds being shipped out. But it looks like whatever Anchorage is doing isn't doing as well as Yakutat is, because they're actually able to export less but get more value for that. Can you explain the difference maybe between the two types of fisheries that shows that those results?
Through the chair, Rep. Tuck, I actually don't have too much information on that. I would assume that Yakutat is primarily shipping out salmon and probably some crab and halibut as well. There's not as many fisheries in the Anchorage area. I mean, you do have Upper Cook Inlet, which is, you know, a commercial fishery too, but they're just not as prevalent.
Okay.
But I could find more information out for you if you'd like.
That's fine. Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Through the chair. I believe Yakutat has probably one of the higher ports of selling king salmon, which has a higher value per pound than coho, which Anchorage gets a lot more from Upper Cook Inlet. But I just wanted to make sure we had a public shout out to Frances. Made a note of her father, you know, as being a 77-year-old gillnetter, but I was just going to say he's kind of a legendary throwdown gillnetter, and all the young bucks try and keep up with him during the season, and he hosts an infamous end of season, because gillnetters fish when they're open. They go 24 hours a day based on the tide, so they fish through the night and stuff. And he's one of those guys who might not fish the midnight tide, but he's fishing the 4 a.m. tide and getting more fish than everybody else. And then usually a day or so right after closure, he throws a end-of-season barbecue and invites all the young guys who come crawling in off their deck. And he's fresh and festive and has got every, you know, hundreds of pounds of shellfish shucked and fish on the grill, and can't figure out why those guys are so tired. And it's sort of always at the end of the season that the gillnetters are all like, they want to be like Mr. Leach, but none of them have figured out how to keep that legend going.
I strive as well.
Representative Sponholz.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about the Alaska Hire sort of portion of the processing industry. My brother-in-law used to work in fish processing out of Naknek, and they often had trouble recruiting and hiring enough Alaskans and even enough Americans to do the fish processing, and so they were often recruiting overseas for people that wanted to come to Alaska, and I wanted to ask about that.
Through the chair, Rep. Sponholz, I don't have a lot of information on why that's happening. I'm sure we could ask the Department of Labor, and of course, fish processors would have a better idea. I know, you know, when I was in high school, pretty much everyone in my high school worked in the processing plant unless you were working on a fishing boat. That's just not happening now. You know, and colleges, you know, you'd still see a lot of college kids coming up. A lot, I will say, in the more rural villages, like a community like Igigig, they actually can't support it with just the people that live there alone. So people do have to come in and help with that. You know, my only guess would be, and this is just a guess, is that, you know, youth in towns that would normally have taken these jobs, there's other options for them now. And if they want to work 12, 14-hour shifts in a cold storage versus a tourist shop or something, I'm just not sure.
I guess I might be interested in hearing from the Department of Labor about that, because I, too, remember growing up, even in Anchorage, you know, a lot of my friends from high school went and worked in the fishing industry, and they did fish processing and other things, and I just don't seem to be hearing as much about it, and I'm wondering if there isn't something that we should be doing to try to, you know, make sure that more Alaskans are doing that work. I mean, I don't have objections to bringing in people from outside to do the work if there's no other solution, but if it's just that, you know, people don't know each other the way they used to know each other, and so maybe a lot of new, you know, newer Alaskans don't know about this opportunity or what. But I think it's important that we try to get as many Alaskans working in this industry as possible to make sort of get maximum value for our limited resources.
Representative Rocher.
Yeah, I think Representative had his up first, and I just want to be polite.
No, I'm good.
You good?
Yeah.
Just to follow up on what Representative Sponholz was talking about, I actually worked the other canneries when I first came here in the mid-70s, and it was very well advertised that this was an excellent opportunity and an excellent chance to get a head start in a lot of ways because of the many hours that you put in. And so just bouncing off of what she had previously stated, I'm thinking, is it advertising? You never hardly hear about it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering whether it's as well known as a very good option anymore. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I'm not 100% sure.
Right.
I do know, I mean, when I was in college, there were tons of people recruiting at my university, and there were a lot of college students that would ask me, is this a good gig, should I do it? And you know. So I know that it had happened when I was there, but that was quite a while ago.
Did you have a comment, Rep. Tallarico?
No.
Okay.
And follow up, I do want to thank you for your presentation. This answered a lot of questions, I think, that we had in the previous presentation. At least it answered a lot of mine. Some that were never even asked, but I was thinking about, and so I thought it was really good. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Representative Hannon?
Thank you. The labor thing, both as a high school teacher, and then I spent a couple years working with adult reentry workers here right after I retired from teaching high school. And I think one of the things that we forget in Alaska, that a generation ago, that was your best choice for making a bunch of money in the summer. And Alaska's affluence and growth in other industry sectors now provide the opportunity for earnings that are not necessarily dependent, because when you sign on to go work at a processor, you're predicting that you're going to make a lot of money, but it's all depending on how that fishery goes. If you sign up to work in a tourism sector, knowing that the ships are going to come in and there's going to be jobs, whether it's tour guiding or working in a support sector, it's almost a more absolute guarantee, and you can do it in town. You don't have to go to a remote location. So almost all the processors speak to the fact that the local kids no longer kids, college age, they'd rather get a sure thing and still be able to go home at night versus live at the processor in the bunkhouse. The flyer that wasn't part of the presentation, but one of the handouts that UFA provided, talks about crew members and coming from every territory in the U.S. except for the Northern Marianas Islands. And one of the things we've seen is that a lot of crews, like the entire crew, will be from American Samoa. So the processor hires them to work this processor here and then go to another fishery that they work. And one of the processors here in Juneau has been, for the last few years, uses a lot of the foreign worker visas for night. The processor runs 24 hours a day in the winter, you know, from different fisheries. And you know, that $12 an hour seems really good if you're coming from the Ukraine, but the Alaskan kid goes, well, I can work at a restaurant for $15 an hour. So really, it's the curse of affluence of Alaska's industries have so diversified as tourism has grown that we don't do the hard labor jobs. Because most fish processing jobs are not glamorous. They're really physically demanding, and the hours are really erratic. So some years you make a lot of money, and some years you're just breaking even. But if you're coming from somewhere else that has fewer economic opportunities, you're willing to take that risk.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Yeah, I know a few years ago there was the concern about pirate vessels coming over and illegally harvesting our fish. Is that still a big problem? Has it been cracked down? How is that an issue these days?
I believe, you know, it is. It's still an issue, and it's still a threat that those things can happen. I do want to say that it just recently happened. I don't have the details, but I do remember hearing something recently as this summer that a ship was caught that was not a U.S. ship, and they were catching fish illegally.
Quick follow-up. Is that the Coast Guard that patrols that? Is that who does that enforcement?
Yeah, it's the Alaska State Troopers and Wildlife Enforcement, as well as the U.S. Coast Guard.
They have boats out there looking. Are they brown shirts through the fishing game that are out there patrolling it? Who does that?
Through the chair, Rep. Hopkins, sometimes, yes. But also I know that I'm forgetting their name, the Alaska Maritime,
the Marine Exchange?
The Marine Exchange. They actually are also able to track vessels, although I would assume that if someone is out there pirating fish, they probably have their their information turned off so they can't see who it is, but it does happen.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Leach?
I do have one more thing. As Rep. Hannon pointed out, there appears to have been a slide that was missing in this presentation that she commented on that is in the thing. It does talk about more about the breakdown that you were asking. So I'm sorry I didn't get to that, but it is in your packets.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. I'm glad we were able to finally get you before the committee. Thanks for your patience with us as we got you scheduled. So we'll take a brief at ease and get set up for our next presentation from DNR on the A-STAR project. We're back on record, joined by Mr. Jeff Bruno. Also on the line is Faith Martineau with DNR and Steve Masterman. For any questions from the committee, Mr. Bruno, please introduce yourself to the committee and begin your presentation.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jeff Bruno with Department of Natural Resources, Office of Project Management and Permitting, and I'm here today to talk about the Arctic Strategic Transportation and Resource Plan, better known as A-STAR. The plan here today is kind of go over where we've been with the project and where we're going, hopefully answer any questions and give you any clarification you need on kind of what this project is doing and what these efforts are intended to do. As mentioned, Steve Masterman with the division of the director of division of geological and geophysical surveys is on the line, and then my director, Faith Martineau with the Office of Project Management and Permitting is also on the line. So maybe just a real quick background of when this project started was in about 2017, and DNR was doing a lot of close efforts with the North Slope Borough. Also, there was a lot of discussion going on with the NPRA, National Petroleum Reserve, about redoing their planning effort, the Integrated Activity Plan. There was also the North Slope Area Plan. DOT was doing a bunch of transportation plans up there, so there was a lot of different efforts going on. And so at the time, the Commissioner of DOT and DNR got together and looked at reappropriating some money from other projects, and did that and combined about $7.3 million for the A-STAR project, and that's how kind of the A-STAR project got born. So here we have just a couple statements. You know, I really consider this kind of the foundation of A-STAR. These statements kind of help guide and direct us when we're trying to figure out where this project is going. It's not an out-of-the-box project, so it's definitely something that is fluid as we're trying to design what it is and as we talk to the community members and figure out what they are hoping to get out of it. So just real quick, the A-STAR mission is to identify, evaluate, and advance opportunities that focus on enhancing the quality of life and economic opportunities in the North Slope, North Slope communities through responsible infrastructure development. The idea with this presentation is that hopefully walk you through each of those components and how we plan on accomplishing them, specifically how we identify projects, how we are digitally mapping this data and creating a database for analyzing this project, and also how we would advance these projects. But probably a better way, instead of saying advance, is really we're trying to identify data gaps throughout the region and kind of fill those data gaps. Steve will talk a little more about that later in the presentation, but that's talking about like gravel surveys, LIDAR, lake surveys, and other things that would be beneficial to trying to assess whether a project is feasible or not for communities and other regional entities. So to do that, we want to prioritize community projects and analyze which projects have the most cumulative benefit for a specific project or region. In other words, which projects enhance the quality of life and economic opportunity. To do that, we had to kind of define what this term cumulative benefit means. You can see the benefit criteria up there. We really kind of piggybacked off the North Slope Borough includes these criteria in their comprehensive plans. As kind of what they've worked out with a lot of the community and residents for the priority values. So we use these to kind of evaluate what cumulative benefit means. In other words, these criteria, no particular, does any given project improve or protect cultural community connectivity? Does it preserve or enhance subsistence traditions, improve health or safety conditions, enhance workforce development, improve access to education, and does it lower the price of costs and goods and services? By assessing how each of these projects impacts those criteria, we were able to find out how beneficial a project is on a community or region. When I say we are able to, we're still in the process of working that out and getting out to the communities and trying to evaluate how they feel about each of these projects. So we are going out to the communities and talking to them about every single project, asking them to rate these projects, and working with them to make sure that their values and inputs are put into this term cumulative input and how we analyze these projects. So here's a list of all of our partners, and not all of them, but our primary partner is the North Slope Borough, and this is really a collaboration with the North Slope Borough and Department of Natural Resources. But that being said, there are a lot of other state agencies that are working on this project, and also federal agencies, and ideally each of the communities is an informal partner on this. And those communities are the communities within the North Slope Borough, but include Point Hope, Point Lay, Uktiavik, Kektovik, New Iksik, Wainwright, Akusuk, and Anituvik Pass. Again, the boundary of A-Star pretty much follows the boundary of the borough, and it crosses a lot of different political boundaries. It has state land, goes through the MPRA. Private lands are included in there. We try not to focus too much on those. And then there's also lands within ANWR also, and it pretty much just goes from Point Hope to the Canadian border. You can see some of the other key players. Department DGGS is the department that Steve works for that we were talking about. They're kind of the leads for the field work and the new terrain mapping that we're doing. We also have the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, Division of Oil and Gas, and my office, the Office of Project Management, Office of Project Permitting and Project Management, that kind of forms the core internal DNR team. Some of the other partners listed on here are Health and Social Services. They helped us compile our base healthline information. They did that with the North Slope Borough, and that helps inform us on some levels. And then DOT obviously was a funding source for this, but also integrating their activities and planning efforts into this process is important to us. These partners are essential because we are trying to create a single database that can kind of look at all these efforts and kind of visualize them, and then allows us to review them analyze these projects on a community level, but also specifically on a regional level too.
Representative Hanning.
Thank you. Through the chair, could you tell me where the nexus is for the Department of Health and Social Services to interact? Because I sort of get all the other, how the other agencies would be working, and you know, when do they engage in the process?
Representative Hannon, through the chair. This team specifically with the Department of Health and Social Services works with DNR on a lot of different projects. They were originally the health impact assessment team, but we did not do a health impact assessment. So we just want to make sure that we compiled all the health statistics that were relevant to this area. We've done that on a lot of different resource development projects for that. Combination with the North Slope Borough's health assessment team also, just assuring that the information that's being put forward is accurate and up to date.
Thank you.
So what are we hoping to accomplish with this? First and foremost, we want to develop a process that the foundation is really built on community values and inputs. To do this, we need to visit each of the communities and talk to them about their value and system, how they prioritize these different values, and how those all are impacted by the different projects that the communities want. We are also doing just a robust stakeholder engagement process. We've already been out once, and I'll talk a little more about this, and we're currently in round two of that. We are also creating detailed digital mapping of North Slope terrain. This is being done by digitally mapping the terrain and other features in a program known as GIS, which stands for Geospatial Information Systems, and allows us to kind of analyze the projects at that level. Steve Masterman will talk a little bit more about that in a couple slides. So once we've developed the projects, which is known as the project library, and developed some new terrain mapping and different data layers, we're developing a database that captures all these new mapping efforts, houses all the different planning efforts, community projects, future resource development projects on the slope, and kind of allows a tool that will analyze those things and allows communities and other entities to analyze this information and make informed decisions on future projects. For the purposes of A-STAR, projects that have the greatest positive impacts on the communities will in turn have the greatest potential for cumulative benefit. Again, that relates back to that benefit criteria. How does each project affect that that criteria? And we ask the communities to help us rate those. We ask the communities to actually rate those. We don't even try to help too much. In turn, after that, the A-STAR team is also trying to identify data gaps. This is really can be a lot of different things, but you know, in NPRA, one of the scarce resources is gravel. So we're trying to identify where there are gravel resources. Potentially, we can fly LIDAR, lake surveys, depending on what the needs are, and we're trying to fill what data gaps we can. So we can give some products that will live long beyond the A-STAR funding and project and will hopefully help make decisions in the future.
I've got a question. So the economic opportunities in the region, does that include resource development opportunities? So we're hearing a lot about, you know, benefits to the communities, which is great, but I'm wondering how much, if at all, the, you know, infrastructure that to make resources more accessible is factored into the benefit analysis?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that's a good question. When we look at the projects on a regional scale, those resource development projects factor in a little more. And part of what we're hoping to do is identify where there are opportunities for community infrastructure and resource development infrastructure to kind of combine and look at where they might have some potential to benefit the communities for those resource development projects. So necessarily they don't get factored in, and we're not having the communities score and rate those projects, but we are assessing, you know, do they enable other community projects and trying to make connections that allow us to see where a project can potentially add to regional infrastructure for communities and other things.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, you made a comment that said, well, there's funding. So could you give me the history of when A-STAR started and how long it's funded for? And is it all state funds or are there federal monies engaged in it?
Representative Hannon, through the chair. So there is, in 2017 is when we got this, when the original money was reappropriated. I've only been on this project since January, so take me with a little bit of leeway and I can get better information. But we had to close out some capital projects, actually, to move these funds into the appropriate basket. And that actually took, I think it took until 2018 maybe to get that money moved aside. The funding for this ends in 2020 fiscal year, or June of 2020. And so that's when it ends. So about a year and a couple months.
Thank you. And is all of that state monies or are there federal monies involved?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, thank you. So the A-STAR funds is state money, but we do have certain things that we are commingling money on. With the field work, BLM put some money into that basket. Because we're looking at some things that they also wanted to look at, specifically the gravel resources and stuff like that. So the 7.3 is all state money, but we do look for opportunities to combine that money to get more field studies or more analysis out of it.
Representative Sponholz?
Yeah, I had a follow-up to that. Where was the money reappropriated from?
Representative Sponholz. Through the chair. Originally, it was from DNR, Division of Oil and Gas, and Department of Transportation.
Thank you.
So let's see. We were developing the project library, and once we get the train unit mapping, we're looking at creating a database that kind of houses all this information, allows us to analyze it. So we're trying to get out into the field with DGGS, and they'll go out into the field and collect that relevant data to hopefully support future decision making. So the first step is identifying the projects, as we talked a little about. This is what we are calling the project library. The project library is where we capture community and regional projects for future analysis. To date, we've identified over 250 community-specific and regional projects, and that does include some resource development projects, and we've captured that in a database. Projects were captured in pretty much one of two ways. The first way was through literature reviews, where we looked at North Slope Borough comprehensive plans or the NPRA impact fund applications to see what projects the communities were proposing. And then we digitally mapped those and dropped them into the database. The other way that we did it is through community outreach. During round one of our stakeholder engagement, we met with the communities. We gave them a survey to assess the benefit criteria. And we also talked to them about what A-STAR was and tried to capture whatever projects each community needed and wanted. So that was kind of the first round of getting out there. Once those projects have been identified and digitally mapped and put into our database, we're going back out to the communities and working with them to talk to them about the projects that specifically relate back to their community. And we're asking them to, we're trying to figure out, one, is this a complete list of the projects that they want to see identified with their community, but also try to understand their priorities and values, and then ask them to tell us how each of those, and it comes back to that benefit criteria we were talking about earlier, how does each project in their community impact those values, and trying to give it a rating system. From there, the analysis tool will help kind of identify how they prioritize those projects and take a look at it.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Does the North Slope Borough kick in any money for this?
Representative Hannon, through the chair. Yes, I don't know what that number is, but they definitely have been supportive. They've also gone with us when we go out to the communities as part of our team. Usually it's our contractor, the lead, which is myself, and the North Slope Borough.
One follow-up. And at the end, when you've got this data library, does that mean that the North Slope Borough communities that participated have rights to use that data in perpetuity, or is that data, you know, the intellectual property, is it owned by the state, or is it equally owned by the borough?
Representative Hannon, through the chair. The idea is that this information will be publicly available, and that we'll try to develop these tools, and the data that Steve is going to go over here in a little bit will be something that the communities and any stakeholder in the region would be able to utilize in perpetuity.
Great. Thank you.
So we're going out to the communities and asking them how each of these projects impacts those values. This is important just because it assures that the community perspective is given to these projects, and that we are representing each individual community also, and how they feel about projects. And it varies from community to community, how they value different benefits and how those relate to their projects. Currently, we're in round two of stakeholder engagement, which is getting out to each community. And we are asking them, you know, we're doing a survey with them called the Pairwise Survey that you can see on there. And it's really kind of asking them some tough questions, I think. You know, it's asking them not just are these values important, but which one's more important to you? Is health and safety more important than lowering the cost of goods? And if so, how much more important? And so it really forces them to compare those values against each other and helps us identify a little more which values are should be prioritized. So we are currently doing that. Once we have completed round two, then we'll be able to input all this data into the database that we're using, run the analysis, and we'll go back out for a third and final round, is the idea, to verify the information, give the tools that we were just talking about to the community, and let them and roll out all the information and data that we collected from this project. So we keep on using this term cumulative benefit. It's something that was probably termed out of, I mean, we looked it up. There wasn't much on this kind of term, so it's something that we kind of developed through the A-STAR program And something that we've worked with the communities to help us kind of identify what that means. And it's really kind of the basis of how this tool and analysis is going to work in the database. So we've collected all these projects, and we've gotten the perspective from the communities how to incorporate this model. And we have to create this tool, and that's what our contractors have been doing a lot of in the last couple months. This tool will incorporate the project library. It will include the values of the stakeholders and benefits. It will map potential connections between communities and projects, kind of like what we were talking about for the resource development projects and how they relate to community projects. We developed this, the model will be developed using, you know, established proven peer-reviewed methodologies. For this one, it's called the Analytic Hierarchy Process, AHP. I don't have any specific information on that right now, but I can get that if anybody's interested. And in coordination with that pairwise survey, it really does help us understand the values and kind of give a math equation to our analysis on how to value these projects. But again, those inputs are really based on community inputs that we go out and collect and ask the leadership, how they value each of these, what scores they want to see on them, and then we go back and run the analysis. So this tool will identify which projects have the potential for the most cumulative benefit to each community on a community level, but also on a regional level, and offer the perspective of how to view both projects from a benefit standpoint, but also the ability to create countless different maps and types of analysis through these tools, and offer a bunch of different visuals. And that's really kind of the GIS software that we were talking about. So this kind of covers, you know, how we'll identify and how we evaluate ASAR data. From there in the process, kind of what we talked about a little more is how we identify the data gaps and how we are going to fill those data gaps. And how we're working with the North Slope Borough and other permitting authorities to get out in the field right now to do some of that work. So Steve Masterman is going to go in a little more detail about what mapping efforts has been done and how it'll be a useful tool and the upcoming field work that his team is planning for this year. I think he's on the phone.
Mr. Masterman, are you online?
Yes, good afternoon, everybody, and greetings from a very sunny Fairbanks.
Thank you for joining us today. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and provide your part of the presentation.
Yes, my name is Stephen Masterman. I'm the director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. And as Jeff mentioned, I'm going to talk a little bit about the work that we are doing in support of the ASTAR project, primarily in collecting and compiling data for a sand and gravel inventory of the part of the North Slope that we have prioritized for this work. As some of you may be aware, sand and gravel resources on the western North Slope particularly are quite sparse, and some of the communities, Ukiavik and Atkasuk and Wainwright and Nuiqsut as well probably, have supply issues with sand and gravel for community development as well as resource development projects. And that was identified pretty early in the ASTAR project, and at the same time, it was also identified by the Bureau of Land Management, who approached us to conduct a sand and gravel inventory or assessment of the portions of the NPRA for them. And as Mr. Bruno indicated, that's where some of the matching funds have come from for this work, so they have been financially contributing toward this effort. So what we have been doing in support of both the BLM and the ASTAR project is compiling all of the existing information that is present around the communities that has been provided by any of the resource development industries, by the Department of Transportation, and also the published geology maps and reports, to put all that stuff together to understand the geology of the area. And then we have been having a contractor do what is called terrain unit mapping. And so they are looking at the superficial features on the surface of the coastal plain, and basically breaking that into units. And we will be going out into the field this summer to characterize what those units are and how they may relate to the availability of sand and gravel resources. A major part of the effort that we're currently going through is working our way through all of the shuttle samples that are present from the area that we're working in. And at the Geological Materials Center in Anchorage, there's probably about 80,000 shuttle samples from across the North Slope. And these are samples from the shuttles that were drilled for the seismic exploration work that's been done up there. And so there are physical samples from depth of, say, 30 to 60 feet at most, if not all, but most of those locations. And on the slide, there's a little map in the lower left-hand corner there that shows the area of some of those lines of shot holes. And so we are going through those at the Geological Materials Center and assessing which of those have sand and gravel in them. And it looks like it's a slow process, but it looks like about somewhere between 5 and 10% of the samples have sand and gravel, which is quite encouraging for us, as very little is present on the surface. So that work is ongoing. We are compiling existing information. We are mapping the surface units. And as we integrate those data layers together, we were going to generate some areas to actually go out into the field and do some field exploration. So that is planned for this summer. We are going to be drilling out in the MPRA with Department of Transportation drill crew and drill. We'll spend about 3 weeks out there. We're going to target some of the areas that we have pretty good indication from our shot hole work and from the terrain unit mapping that have the good potential for sand and gravel resources. And once we get down to that effort, we will be compiling all of the information, obviously providing it to the project to incorporate into their data set, and we will be publishing that information through our normal channels and making it all available to not only the communities but any resource development activities up there.
Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. My question is, could you explain what shot hole mapping and sampling is? So I understand what GIS and 3D sampling is, but is shot hole actually more, it's a physical hole and you have a core sample of all the materials in it, or is it still computer technology?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Hannah, that's a great question. These are actual physical samples. So when, you know, in the 1960s and 70s and even earlier, probably into the 80s too, when they went out to shoot a two-dimensional seismic line, they would take a drill rig out there and they would drill a hole every, say, quarter mile, and they would put some explosives in that hole. And when they detonated those explosives, that would create the shock wave that they would then subsequently record to get the seismic information. But when they drilled that hole, they had a geologist there, or they had the driller there, and the driller would make some rudimentary notes about what was coming out of the hole. And in many cases, they bagged up some of that material and put the sample card in it that described the hole and where it was and what they saw. And that's what we have at the Geologic Materials Center in Anchorage, and so that's what our crews are going through. So that's a pretty incredible collection of physical materials from, you know, 30 to 60 foot depth across the coastal plain. And it's you know, to go out and replicate and recollect that information would be many, many millions of dollars. So it's money well spent to go through that. Even though it's time consuming, it's money well spent to go through that material and harvest what data we can.
Thank you.
So the next slide is just a picture of the area within which we are working, and this is the terrain unit mapping that has been done by the contractor. They're breaking the coastal plain into a series of geologic units that will relate to how you know, that part of the state was formed, or the surface of that part of the state was formed. And that's going to be very helpful for not only our work this summer to go out and find hopefully find some sand and gravel, but it will be very helpful for any and all community or resource development projects that occur in these areas. So it's a pretty nice piece of work. As you can see, it's broken into three areas. Areas 1 and 2 are complete, and we expect to get delivery in Area 3 shortly.
So I want to let the record reflect that Representative Rasmussen's joined us.
I think that concludes. If there are any, unless there are any further questions, I'll pass it back over to Mr. Bruno.
I don't see any questions. Thank you, Mr. Masterman.
So just a quick budget overview. We kind of talked about how we got appropriated the original 7.3. To date, we've spent about 1.4. I think we just did some billing, so it might be a little above that at this point. That money is mainly just to kind of go over what that money's been spent on, community and stakeholder outreach during round one and some of round two. Identifying 250 community projects through literature reviews and stakeholder engagement, capturing those projects and digitally mapping them in the GIS, and creating a database and tools to help to house that information and help analyze it, developing the train unit mapping that Steve just went over, logging shot hole and bore hole data, developing the tools and models for this information, and then we've also created a transportation plan that is being finalized and that analyzes freight and passenger transportation patterns and costs. That'll also be a product from this. And then we're currently working with federal agencies and the North Slope Borough to permit the upcoming field season that we just talked about. We still have about $5.5 million obligated. Most of that work is related to contractual services, both for our data analysis, but also the field work. We are also continuing to do the train unit mapping. Round two and round three of stakeholder engagement is also included in that. And concluding this with a strategic plan that will go out to the communities and will roll out all the different information and try to house summarize it all in one concise document. So just kind of wrap it up, what we're thinking for where the next steps are going. We're going to complete round two of stakeholder engagement. That will probably be sometime this fall or winter. We tried to get out to a couple communities recently. We got weathered in and only were able to do point lays, so we still have some additional communities to go to. Additional surveys will be done and some project evaluation at the community level with the community leaders. We'll finish up the cumulative benefit tool as we kind of put those inputs into it. We'll have to run and verify the tool for assessing priority projects, continue the terrain unit mapping, finish the database with the tools and models, and then additionally continue on with our field work that we're looking at and conduct the final round of outreach for the A-STAR and deliver the final products.
Any questions? So when do you expect the final report or the final product?
Mr. Chair, we expect that by next year, June.
June?
Yeah.
Okay.
By the end of the project and the funding. Okay.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, and I apologize for just having to step out for a second, and I don't know if I missed the specifics on this. When you're looking at projects and infrastructure and return on investment and things like that and helping generate economies, have you guys looked at broadband and internet access and how that is impacted up there and what steps we might be able to help move it along?
Yeah, Representative Hopkins through the chair. We look at all different kinds of projects, and we really aren't filtering too much. It just has to be a project, a physical project, you know, road, telecom, wind energy. So there's a lot of different things, and consistently we see that that kind of project really rises to the top for internet and stuff like that. It really has a community value across the region and keeps on hitting what we keep on talking about, cumulative benefit, and really is one of the high ranking projects that keeps on coming.
Good to hear. Thank you.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you through the chair. On your budget, when you the bulk of the money is obligated. So can you give me a, can you expand on that a little bit? Are those contractors have already been hired to do the set specific work and through the summer and fall?
Mm-hmm. Representative Hannon, through the chair. Yeah, that's a bulk of it's the bulk of it's going into the field work that's coming up this season. Field work up there isn't cheap, has a little bit of a higher MOB and DMOB cost, and then continuing with our contractors and what they're working on. We had, like as I was mentioning, there was some delays in moving the money around too, so we had to kind of backload some of that.
Okay. Any other questions, committee? Thank you, Mr. Bruno and Mr. Masterman. Thanks for being on the line, Director Martineau. We did have one invited testifier on the line. Mr. Brower, are you there?
Yeah, hello. This is Gordon Brower.
Hi.
With the North Suburban Planning and Community Services.
And Mr. Brower, thank you for taking time out of the spring whaling season to visit with us today. Please please begin your testimony.
You're welcome. And there's a lot of whales are running through right now, so it was kind of hard to get off the ice. Yeah.
Do you have testimony for the committee, or were you available for questions?
Yeah, I didn't exactly know how this was going to unfold, but I can provide a little bit of testimony and then be available for questions, if that's okay.
That'd be great.
Sure. Well, my name's Gordon Brower. I'm the Director for Planning and Community Services. I work for the North Suburban Mayor, Harry Brower, Jr., and, you know, I've been in the planning department for about 28 years for the borough, and we had often talked about, and I deal with quite a bit of infrastructure-related large projects that come through my department, for mostly oil and gas development and other proposals that come to my office. So many of the other things that the North Slope Borough is responsible to carry out is the community services throughout all of the villages on the North Slope. It's been about 40 some years of existence without any connectivity. And quite frankly, when we look at today and the development of the comprehensive plans for every community on the North Slope Borough, you know, it's important to realize the needs and the concerns about the high cost of living, the economies up here. We have only basically one economy, and that's oil and gas. And it's not to say that other potential economies could flourish like coal. And there's been demonstrations of these activities from the 1990s and 1980s, one called Dead Falls Syncline Coal Demonstration Project between ASRC and the borough to evaluate and do some coal mining to the western part of the North Slope Borough. These projects come and go because of the lack of infrastructure within the North Slope Borough to carry them out. And by the way, the coal that's being evaluated up here is more than 100 years supply of this metallurgical coal. It's a shipbuilding coal. It's a very important low sulfur type coal that exists up here. So just a little frame of other things that we're responsible to carry out our infrastructure needs and and try to reduce to the best of our ability the cost of the high cost of living that we live in. Many of the communities experience fuel that is like $11 and $12 a gallon for use. While the primary activities in our villages are about 80% subsistence, and the other part of the economy is basically the school systems, the public works of keeping the communities clear, and the housing that is going on. So there's a very limited opportunities up here. I would like to just also emphasize one project that the mayor has taken. It's called the Community Winter Access Trail. And it is kind of an offshoot of A-Star and other planning initiatives, especially when resource development within the North Slope Borough, like oil and gas discoveries, are publicized, and they're large scale, and I could name a few of those types of projects, but it's important to start to realize that it's a different era up here, and that these planning initiatives for oil and gas development and other developments and things that need to get done in a more cost-efficient manner requires infrastructure like roads to be able to accomplish that. And you can't really build roads independently to communities. You need to have foundation projects and not just be an oil and gas planning exercise anymore because of our community's needs. And you have to realize up here in the Arctic, the borough subsidizes about $20 million worth of energy needs to all of its communities up here. And it's quite frankly, I think, unsustainable that we work together when there's these large project reviews that can work towards connectivity and working together in those types of approaches. So the planning initiatives that are going on up here in the Arctic include DOT's Northwest Area Transportation Plan and the North Slope Borough's Comprehensive Plan. A component of that is the Transportation Plan. And then these large oil discoveries, like in Smith Bay, Kalis announced a $6.8 billion field that was discovered just 2 years ago in Smith Bay, but it's you can't reach it. It's in state water, near shore, bordered by the NPRA, in nestled just outside a barrel, about 40 miles outside a barrel. So it seems to me that working together, that we can accomplish things that can provide the community's path forward, all the while improving the climate for resource development with these infrastructure projects like oil and gas and coal, and not to mention lead and zinc within parts of the borough properties in the NPRA. So it's important to look at the holistic picture and find common ground as we move forward with responsible development and balancing to making sure the subsistence resources and those activities that we depend on for subsistence can still flourish. And I think we've done that with the last 40 years with oil and gas development. I'm confident we can move forward with some of these. Lastly, back in 1985 or 1984, an act was passed by the Congress. It was called the Barrel Gas Transfer Act of 1984, which required us to work with industry and BLM to where that when we can evaluate those needs and make more accessible natural gas to our communities, that this Natural Gas Transfer Act would help facilitate that energy resource to our communities. And it seems to me that we need to use all of the tools at hand and to work together to make some of these energy needs and energy security in the Arctic a reality instead of this huge vacuum of energy leaving the state through the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, that we can work together to have more in-state use of these resources as well. So with that, I can go on and on with the many different examples of why, including the roads to resources that's been here. I've been here quite a long time and been involved with roads to resources that frankly go nowhere because of the lack of support from the either from the North Slope Borough or from the general public. But we're seeing through A-STAR and the connectivity and making more concerted effort to plan for communities, all the while looking at the energy resources and plan holistically together. I think that's being more embraced today more than ever. With that, I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brower. That was really helpful. Any questions from the committee? Co-Chair Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that information. And pardon me because I had to step out and I might have missed this if you said it. But on the energy front, are there any other small-scale opportunities that we should be thinking about? I know when the 2008, 2009, in that time frame when the Reinvestment and Recovery Act was passed, there was a bunch of money. And I know some of it was used for small-scale projects, and I don't know if there's anything like that going on that we should know about or be thinking about.
In terms of energy, I know there's some innovative ways that smaller independent operators are trying to forge ahead to develop in new, more cost-efficient ways, like the Mustang project. That Brooks Range was, I think, partnering with the state through ADA, and that made its way to the assembly to gain support, to get that level of support from ADA. Those types of projects, including, I think, USGS demonstration coal bed methane projects that were outside of Wainwright, and I don't know if maybe that might have been part of the Department of Energy as well, that trying to look at ways how we could impact energy development in other ways other than just oil and gas development, but looking at local resources in those kind of things. There's another kind of, I think it's called gas hydrates, which I think they're starting to figure that Barrow is served by gas hydrate formation, so the evaluation of some of these things, the boroughs put a lot of resources to trying to find alternative ways to develop energy resources to benefit the communities up in this part of the in this part of the Arctic. I'm not exactly sure that was what you were looking for. Being in planning, these are the types of things I'm used to looking at.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Brower? I don't see any. Thank you again for joining us, and we better let you go before all the whales get away. Mm-hmm. Hope to see you up north this summer.
All right. I hope I was helpful, and we are encouraged by this project and the synergies that it provides moving forward so that we all can, I think, if we can all sing from the same sheet of paper, the funding would not be fragmented as much. If the DOT and the A-STAR and the Burns Comprehensive Plan in these transportation planning exercises and cost-benefit analysis looks at these together, I think we're serving the state better, we're serving the residents of the North Slope better by singing from the same sheet of paper.
I like the sound of that. Thank you, Mr. Bruno, for the presentation and all of our callers for participating today. Our last order of business is taking up House Resolution 8 by Representative Tarr, and we will take a brief at ease to get that set up. Thank you all again.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Record, and we have House Resolution 8 before the committee. We've had two amendments that were filed by Representative Rauscher.
Rep Tarr. That one's me.
So which are we doing first?
We could do that one. Okay. I can move that one.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move amendment number one, which will be the one that's 31-LS0667/U.3.
Thank you. Is there an objection? Yeah. Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Rep. Tarr, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Sure. There are two parts to this, and this resolution had been in House Fisheries right before this, but we moved it out on the same day, and Representative Newman had an interest in this whereas clause, had brought up the concept of recognizing the stocks of concern in Alaska. And so we worked with his office to develop this whereas clause to integrate into that, and thought that was a good item to bring into the resolution. And then I noticed on the second part, adding the two governors, that we're working with the legislators in those two other states, and in both of their resolutions, they had to send them to Alaska. And so I just thought it'd be good to be consistent, and we'll send ours to them. And so just wanted to add those in.
Representative Rasmussen's removed her objection. Is there any other objection?
I don't have an objection. I just want to talk.
You want to object for the purpose of discussion?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, she removed it?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, then I object purpose to discuss. Through the chair, In Representative Newman's amendment, he talks about elevating and addresses it as a priority, and I'm not sure that that's identified that way in this amendment, and so I guess I'm asking the maker of the amendment to speak to that.
So there were two versions of this, and the first one, he had it in the be it resolved, but there's no fiscal note or anything attached to this, so we wanted to be careful about the be it resolves clause. So right now, the be it resolved clause are more in recognition of the 2019 Year of the Salmon and the associated effort with that. But if you put this idea into a be it resolved, it was actually like calling on the state to do more research and sort of suggested more like a policy statement. And so we wanted to put it in a whereas clause. So we brought the issue up and addressed it in the resolution without it sort of kind of adding a policy statement that was separate from just recognition of the International Year of the Salmon.
Follow up. So okay, I'll think about this. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair and to the maker of the amendment, I guess with that framing, and I was a little thrown off of its placement, because right now on line 24, this amendment comes in after the resolves statements as opposed to following the rest of the whereases.
No. Representative Hannon, pardon me for interrupting you, but if you're on page 2.
I'm on page 3. Yes. There we go. Thank you.
Yes.
I know you're all looking through the chair, looking to me to remove or to keep my objection. I'm going to, I said my piece, I'll remove my objection.
Okay. Is there any other objection? Seeing none, Amendment 1 is adopted. Moving on to Amendment 2.
At this time, I'd like to move Amendment Number 31-LS0667/U.2.
I think you, Representative Rauscher, is there an objection?
I'll object for discussion.
Thank you.
To me, it's kind of self-explanatory, and I'm not saying that to insult anyone. I'm just saying I thought that it would be a good ending that we denote the significance of our industry here and our fishery. So I just thought it was very important that we denote that it is not just in our state, not just in our country, but internationally. And that's the purpose of the amendment. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. That was considered a friendly amendment, and I removed my objection.
Thank you.
Any other objection? Seeing none, Amendment 2 is adopted. Are there any other questions or comments from the committee regarding the resolution? Seeing none, can I have a motion, please?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report H.R. 8, 31-LS0667/U, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note out of committee.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you.
Any objections? There being no objection, H.R. 8 labeled 31-LS0667/U as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note moves from committee. Next Monday, April 29, the committee will hear Senate Bill 43 extending the Big Game Commercial Services Board and take public testimony, as well as House Bill 138, the National Resource Water Designation, and take public testimony. Please stay to sign the committee report, and with no further business before the committee, we will adjourn at 2:36 p.m.